Hello again, for those of you who I saw earlier. On this last Sunday in June, our last day of practice of the season, until the autumn, although we will have a week's practice at the end of August. And so this day rounds out our year of practice in the Zoom Zendo. I'm not sure. I'm sure we will have some practice in the Zoom Zendo in the fall, but I'm not sure what. So I'm trying to stay very present with this day and appreciate it for what it is. During the break, I went into my garden and cut a branch for the Jukai ceremony that will happen later. And this branch comes from the tree that I received when I received transmission, so 17 years ago. And when I received it, it was not much bigger than this, the tree. And now it is towering above the house behind us. It was not easy to reach a branch, to take a branch from. But I managed, and I was thinking about that tree, and like I said, it started out about this size, a little bigger, but not much. And we planted it in that spot in the garden 17 years ago, and for a long time the tree struggled. It was small. It was overshadowed by there was an old apple tree next to it that cut off a lot of its sunlight. And even when that old apple tree died and was removed, the tree was overshadowed by the neighbor's trees and house. And of course, you know that the neighbor's trees and the neighbor's house is the Dana Center, where my teacher lives, right? And so this was always a very strong metaphor for me that my tree was struggling to find its light in the shadow of my teacher's trees and house. And the tree, when it began finding its way, it grew very crooked like this because it was going into the way it could find the sunlight. And then when it became tall enough so that it could find its sunlight, it started growing straight. But the bottom of it and the is still crooked like this. And then it's growing up straight. Straight-ish is, you know, I'm not sure trees are ever completely straight, but straighter, let's say. And I really love this. I love this tree, and the whole what it has manifested, along with me, as I have manifested the way as well, and. I don't know, my teacher, Geno Roshi, she received her transmission in Poland and so planted her tree in Poland there where she was spending, I think she was there for a year and a half doing 3-month retreats. And then there would be a break and then another 3-month retreat and then a break. And so she planted the tree there. And I think she has no idea what has become of that tree. my Dharma brother Frank planted his tree in Ketsand, which is where he received transmission, a place in Belgium where he still goes for retreats. And so I'm assuming he still visits that tree. My Dharma sister Corinne Sensei, she said her tree when she received it was already dead. I don't know if that's true. She complains bitterly about that. And so her tree is no longer with us. My other two Dharma brothers, Michel and João, I don't know. I haven't asked them about their trees, but I was fortunate to have the possibility to plant my tree in my garden and watch it grow as I grew and as my Sangha grows and as you grow. And some of the people who are receiving Jukai today have, you know, I've known since the tree was quite small. And so they have grown with this tree as well. I see that Freddie has arrived. So the three of them are together. They're finishing up Tomas's Rakusu, I think. Looks like a collective effort there. And I was thinking, okay, so it's just a tree, right? I mean, it's just a tree. It's a specific kind of pine tree, though, with these long needles. And actually, my Geno Roshi, the one that she used when I received Jukai, there were seven of us, someone took it and had it dipped in gold. And so she still has it. It's been preserved in gold. And so she has the branch somewhere in her things. But it's just a tree, right? It's just a pine branch. So why do we put so much meaning in it? You know, why am I attached to it? And am I attached to it by feeling my link with it, feeling our progression together? So what is this about, this tree and branch and all this? There's a, I think he's from the 18th century, a Polish rabbi who we often quote with various quotes because he says beautiful things. His name was Menachem Ben Mendel, Rabbi Menachem Mendel. And one of my favorite quotes of his is, he says, God is found wherever he is given entry. Now, when we say God, you know, as Joyce wrote in Ulysses, what is God? A shout in the street. We're not talking about some higher being that lives somewhere that is unattainable, something transcendent, some all-powerful force that we can never meet, that we can never attain. We're talking about the God of small things, as the Indian writer's book is. Or we're talking about it. In Zen, we would say it. Or mu, maybe, we could say. So when he says God is found wherever he is given entry, what does that mean? That means or as you know, that book, The Life of Pi, Life of Pi, I don't know how it's pronounced in English, about the boy who is the young boy who's stuck on a boat, shipwrecked on a boat with a tiger, and it was a movie as well, actually. And he's very spiritual. He's like 14 years old. He's very spiritual and living in India. And he's from a Hindu family, but his family is secular. They don't practice. But he's very spiritual. And so he, through various encounters, he meets he goes to the Hindu temple that is nearest him, and he meets a Christian priest, and he also meets a Muslim imam, and frequents these three teachers. And each teacher doesn't know that he is seeing the other teachers. And his parents don't know this either. Nobody knows that he's practicing these three religions. And at one point he says, or maybe it's one of the teachers who says to him, if you take two steps towards God, God runs to you. So if you take two steps towards it overwhelms you. We have a koan that says, you know, step forward from a 100-foot pole. Every koan, in fact, is asking us to take two steps towards God, actually, into the unknown. And what we find there is ourselves, but not as we think we are. Or Mother Teresa, who said, when asked what she does when she prays, what she says to God when she prays, and she said, I don't say anything, I listen. And then you've heard me say this before, and then the journalist says, well, so what does God say to you? And she says, nothing, he just listens. This is, you know, opening your heart, giving entry to it, listening to it. You know, in our traditional meditation practices, we might say, you know, observe whatever is arising. Observe whatever state is present in your body and mind. Whether it's your knees that hurt, whether it's you're projecting about what you will have for lunch, whether it's feeling bored or angry or scared or uptight or happy, whatever it is, notice it, observe it. This is Mother Teresa's, you know, listening. Pay attention. Look closer. We have all of these different things we say. And then we have a lot of techniques that help us to do this. As I was saying the other day about stripping away so that we can reveal the essence of who we truly are. Stripping away everything we add on. And we have techniques that help us do this. In our practice, there we have just the sitting practice, the basic, very basic sitting practice, which Dogen, who is one of our great ancestors, said, we don't sit in order to become enlightened. Sitting is enlightenment. Now, this is really obscure. This is really difficult to see because it makes no sense. But he, you know, that was his life's work. And he struggled mightily against the Japanese Buddhist establishment at the time because no one wanted to hear that. And he was persecuted and had very few students and fell into obscurity for several centuries until people came upon his writings and realized what he was saying, and then that was all rehabilitated, and he became seen for what we see him today. So it's not that we do this technique of sitting so that we will awaken, but maybe when we sit, we realize that we are awake. That by sitting, all of that stuff that we have covering up our, obscuring our view, obscuring our basic awareness and enlightened state, the clouds float away when we sit. So we don't become something that we were not already. That's what we are already. Like the sun is behind the clouds. It's, you know, it's a gray, rainy day here in Paris, but the sun is there. I just don't see it. And we have other ways of giving God entry or opening the gates, which we realize are not there. There are no gates, actually. There is no door, but we have to open the door in order to see that. So we need to find a way to stay unstuck, to not stay stuck with our attachments and our beliefs and our positions and everything that limits us. Koans are a great practice for that as well, because they maintain us in a constant position of uncertainty. Throughout our work with koans, we learn and we become more skillful at staying unstuck, without fixations, without limitations. But as anyone who does it knows, it's not easy, and it's frustrating, and it's can be discouraging, incomprehensible. But it's almost as if they point to a fundamental ambiguity or maybe they use a fundamental ambiguity and an intentional inconclusiveness so that we can become unstuck, so that we can't be fixed anywhere, which allows us then to open up and give God entry into our heart. The boy in Life of Pi, I think he, if I remember correctly, I read this a long time ago, he saw the beauty of each of these three practices, of these three teachings, these three religions. And what he found was that all of them led to love, loving God and loving others. So that was what he found in all of them. The priest, whenever he would ask them why Christ did this or did that or whatever, the priest always would just say love, which is like a koan. So he never got any fixed answers from this priest. The only thing the priest said was love. I don't remember what the imam and the Hindu guy said, but at the same time, each of these three teachers, he didn't tell them that he was seeing the others, because each one was hanging on tight and protecting their exclusive truth. And the boy didn't see it that way. He saw the beauty in each of them. And for him, there was no problem. But he knew that for each of them, there was. And so he didn't tell them. And he didn't tell his parents either, because his parents were totally secular. They didn't believe in any of this stuff. And then, I don't know, if I can't remember exactly what the situation was, but once he was out with his parents, and through a certain circumstances, he ran into the three teachers. So everyone confronted themselves, and nobody understood why the three teachers all knew the boy. And he suddenly had to then tell, you know. And when he said that he saw the beauty in each, and that he saw that they were different paths to the same thing, everyone was left breathless. Suddenly, they were all very humbled, including his parents. Although I think his father then like hurries the family off to go have ice cream or something. I don't remember the details, but you know, when we think we have the exclusive truth, then we don't see God in this. We don't see God in this. We don't see God in that. And I'm only using God because that's the term that this rabbi used, but we could say it, you know, my Dharma name is you are it. Or you are that. So we can call it this, that, whatever you move. And our life is about manifesting that fully. Opening to who you truly are, to your true self and your way. Each of us has our own exclusive way, but that doesn't eliminate the other ways, the other paths. We each have our own truth, which is unique to us. And yet we all share the same truth, which is that we each have our own truth. That's what we share. Like Bernie Glassman used to say, the only thing we have in common is our differences. So we are one in our diversity. And we are diverse in how we manifest that oneness. I was reading some a while ago, a scholar who my Dharma brother Frank really likes, Stephen Hine, I think, who has studied everything you can imagine about Zen, and particularly Chinese, and writes these scholarly books, but which are really, you know, insightful. Sometimes they offer insight. And I was reading something that he had said about one of the collections of that we use in our koan study. And he went to visit the place in China where this collection originated as part of his research. And he went into the men's room, and above the urinal was written a quote, and it was in Chinese, but he translated it. And it was something, I think it was, lean forward a step so you won't drop urine. And he was really like amused by this, but also thinking, what does this mean? And he said, suddenly my 50 years of Chan research came down to a drop of pee. And I thought, wow, this is amazing that this guy who's so scholarly and so intellectual and like gives all these, you know, elaborate explanations for stuff could let go of it all and say 50 years of Chan research comes down to a drop of pee. Yes, you know. Usually we, you know, we say, take a step back, right? This says, take a step forward, which of course has meaning in the context. But it also, you know, if you take two steps towards God, God comes running to you. That's what made me think of it when I was thinking about this just now. Take a step forward. Pay attention. Be aware. When I lived in the Zen Center next door, at one time, I was the only female student. I was living there with my husband, with Frank, with Simon, and then, of course, my teacher and her partner, but they had their own separate bathroom. And my son was too small to use toilet, and my daughter and I were the two women, and then there were these three men. And inevitably, and women can commiserate with this, there was pee on the toilet seat. And, you know, I used to say to them, come on, you guys, you know, you're in a Zen center. Even if you're not in the Zen center, think of us, you know. I still have no idea who it was who was doing it or in what context or what was going on. And I wasn't trying to find out. But this has meaning for men in a way that it has meaning for women in another way. Anyway, this is kind of a Zen lesson, you know. Lean forward, notice, observe, pay attention, be aware. And so all of these koans and all of this, you know, the collection that was where this is where this collection originated in the 11th or 12th century, you know, and all of this, and it's like become elaborate stories around it and considered this really amazing work of, you know, classic work of Chinese and Japanese literature, and it comes down to one drop of pee. And that this guy should say that, it's pretty incredible. But it does, you know. It really just comes down to that. Just comes down to right now, this breath, this moment, who you are, the situation you're in, being aware of the situation and responding to it. What was the thing we said the other day? What was it I was saying? Responding appropriately, or what is the constant activity of the bodhisattvas? That was it the other day. Someone asks the teacher, what is the constant activity of all Buddhas and bodhisattvas? And so, you know, like, it's this question of, well, what's the, you know, what's special about the daily lives of awakened people, you know, all these great people? And it comes down to one drop of pee. Take a step forward. Responding appropriately. The master actually says responding appropriately. He doesn't say lean forward, not to drop pee, but just this right now, right here, and opening your heart to let it in this moment. Because then, you know, if we think of it in just very ordinary, you know, terms, we could say then you are truly self-reliant. Then you are truly self-aware. If you can see things as you are, if you can see who you truly are, then you don't depend on anything or anyone. And at the same time, you see your full interdependence with all phenomena and all others. And you do what is necessary, knowing that. So you don't, you take care of the environment. You take care of your neighbors. You take care of your animals or your car or your shoes, or you don't waste food. It can manifest in an infinite number of ways once you see who you truly are. And therefore, when you see who you truly are, you see who everyone is. You know God. And you see the face of God on the person in front of you. I think the boy in Life of Pi, I think he really likes Christ because he loves the idea that this incarnation of divinity is, you know, a walking, talking, living being among other walking, talking, living beings. Whereas in the other traditions, you know, in the Hindu tradition, it's all these kind of wild emanations and Ganesh and statues and all kinds of stuff. And in Muslim tradition, you must not show an image. You must not see the face of God. You must not show the face of God. Now, of course, we can say that we cannot see the face of God because it can't be represented in ways that we think it can. It's like, you know, we say with koans, you know, it's, or even when we say about yourself, you are not who you think you are. So that picture of you is not who you are. This image you're looking at on the screen, that's not who you are. But that doesn't mean we say you can't show your image on the screen. What we does mean is look closer, you know, look deeper, widen your perspective, deepen your perspective, magnify it so that you can see even in an infinite tiny piece of sand, the universe, as William Blake famously wrote. Because, you know, God is found wherever he is given entry. And all of that from this little pine branch, right? You know? And of course, this little pine branch started from a tree about this size, but the tree about this size started from, you know, a little grain that someone planted because they bought it in a shop and it was in a pot when I received it. But it's traditional in the transmission ceremony to receive this plant. It's one of the things that we have on the altar, and that has come down generation to generation to generation. So this is the same pine tree that Dogen had. And this is the same pine branch that the rest of you who received Jukai from me, this is the same one. I'm told, and I'm not sure, maybe Freddie can answer this. Brigitte told me that when she bought she went with Freddie to buy the fabric for his Rakusu many, many years ago in Paris. And she told me the other day that she gave him, when she did that, some white material for the back of the Rakusu that she had from her Rakusu. I don't know. Is that true, Freddie? Is that what you used, or did you have some other fabric?
I still have it. It's the same one.
Okay. And now something interesting is, and the reason we talked about this with Brigitte, is Brigitte's Rakusu was stolen from our Zen center when we were broken, when we had the robbery, those of you who know of it. And two rakusus were taken. There were many rakusus there, among them all of my rakusus, you know, some of these like fabulous brocade, beautiful rakusus. There were many black rakusus. There was Joa's purple rakusu. There was Debbie's rakusu, which was new, had just been finished, and nothing had been written on it yet. And there was Brigitte's rakusu, which was among all the other black rakusus. And the robbers took two rakusus, Debbie's, which had nothing written on it, and which was not in the same place as the other rakusus, it was on a different shelf, and Brigitte's. They took it out of the case that it was in. They left the case and took her rakusu. Mysterious. We still have not cracked that koan. Debbie made a new one because she was supposed to be receiving, she had left the rakusu there so that I could write on it for her Jukai ceremony, which was supposed to be, what, like 2 weeks later or something, I don't know. And so she very quickly made another one after she got over the shock and discouragement and everything that you can understand, any of you who have made rakusus, because it's a big thing to do and then it's gone. But Brigitte, who really was not practicing much anymore at that point, didn't make another one and kept the case, but had no rakusu. And now her rakusu is living on in Freddie's rakusu because it's the same white fabric. Same rakusu. It will have a different name on it. It will have different teacher's name on it, different stamp. But it's one. Tomas's rakusu has stitches done by various people, apparently. One rakusu. One tree. One branch. So I think I will stop there and let you speak or ask questions, whatever you might like to share. Debbie, yeah?
Can you tell us more about this tree part? I've never heard this before. Do they give you the tree so you will have the branch, or is it completely different, or what?
No, it's, you know, when, as part of the transmission ceremony, there's various things that you receive. And I think the pine tree is, you know, like probably I could look into it. I probably knew at some point, you know, it's some symbol of evergreen, the life of the teaching that is handed on alive or something. I don't know. And we have the pine branch on the back of our, you know, rakusus as well. But it's not, what did you say? Was it? No. You have to find your branch wherever you can find it. This is the first time I've used a branch from this tree, because this is the first time I have done, maybe I did for yours, Debbie. Maybe I did have one from my tree for you, because that was also in Paris. That's right. Yeah. But no, that's not the, no. You know, you also receive the bowl and the stick and the traditional things.
And also I wanted to thank you for the drop of pee, because of course, like many women, I've been married for 30 years in different settings. It's a living part of our everyday life. So it's interesting to see that this guy found that most beautiful.
Yeah, I don't didn't mean that, like, you know, to be mean to the guys or anything. It's just, yeah. Grisha?
Hi, everyone. Do you listen to me good?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know very well what I'm going to ask, but I feel the need. Let me see if I can do it. It's about when you told us that the boy, the Indian boy, I saw The Life of Pi, the movie. I don't remember that much, and I see it not so many time ago. But when you said that he didn't tell the three priests or the three religions that he was doing the others because he knew or he felt like they strongly hold on to their truth as exclusively, and he didn't saw that way, and somehow he wouldn't like to hurt their feelings, I think, is that, because I recognize myself in that. Sometimes I do that because I don't think it's that important, but I can handle the argumentation that it's behind that. This is the context. My quest or my question or my difficulty sometimes in that, it's about me. In Buddhism, I think, sometimes in precepts or in the things we should do, they are told by, you can read a sutra or whatever. And sometimes when people, usually brothers or sisters in practice, that have more experience than I and know the precepts by heart, the words, but as I see it, don't follow that, you know? And sometimes I want to hold on to the truth and say, remember, the precepts says that, so do it. Don't arrange excuses for yourself. And I think when I'm saying this, I myself, I'm holding on to the truth exclusively. This is when the things get confused to me, and I don't know what I'm asking you, but I have some kind of difficulty in here. I don't know if you can understand me. It's like I can't be humble, and I want to be, but if I'm true, I can't. Sometimes I hold on to the truth in precept as words, you know? No, is this, is not that. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if I'm answering that, what is not really a question, but I think we can probably all relate to this. And this is what our practice is about, is, you know, this, like I said, this fundamental ambiguity or this finding a way to stay unstuck, because that sounds like a paradox, staying unstuck. And yet that's really what where our freedom and truth, you know, truth is a tricky word, but what our basic nature or something, maybe we could say, lies there. And that involves, so when we find ourselves saying things like that, when we do that, we are actually coming from a place, although maybe it comes out in a kind of twisted way, a place of wholeness, goodness, love, and yet it comes out, we say something or we attach to something, and it seems that we are going against that wholeness, love, non-attachment. So maybe if we can, instead of, you know, holding on to the words or the what we think of as the principle of the thing, return to the spirit of it. And the spirit of the precepts are always how we want to live. We want, or how we want is even too much, but returning to our awakened nature, and that this is who we truly are, is not killing, not stealing, not lying, not talking about others' errors and faults, not being intoxicated. And, you know, when we did our precepts course, did you participate in it, Krisha? I think you did, didn't you? Some of it? Yeah? No, some of it, okay. We looked at that, this one of being intoxicated, because it's not just, you know, not, you know, there's no problem drinking a glass of wine or something. There's no, that's not what we're talking about when we talk about being intoxicated. It can be, you know, like drinking ourselves into a state where we're unaware, you know, that it can take that form. But we can also be intoxicated by our concepts of our, we can become intoxicated by oneness. We even looked at that, right? You know, you have this amazing awakening, you know, this glimpse of, you know, the ultimate beauty of all things, and we become intoxicated by that. And then we no longer are present for things just as they are. So if we can return to the spirit of it, that maybe that can, and when you find yourself doing that, not doing that, not returning to the spirit, you can maybe use that as a reminder. Say, oh yeah, so what is really, you know, what is the behavior of the person that I'm trying to point out? What is really behind that for the person and for me, for my reaction? And so what is this? Probably the person is coming from a place of, I don't know what behavior you're pointing out, but, you know, if they're talking about others' errors and faults, it could be coming from a place of doubt. The person is feeling insufficient and lacking confidence or trust in themselves or fear, and therefore blames others, you know, and has to point out someone doing something bad instead of saying, my bad. You know, we have this phrase now today, modern language, my bad. Taking responsibility. And if we're talking about others' errors and faults, we're not taking responsibility. But we know in ourselves when we do that, what's happening. So if you return to yourself and say, okay, well, what's the spirit of it? Then maybe that will change. I don't know if that answered your question, really, Krisha, but that's kind of what I heard and what resonated for me.
Yes, it did, the almost question, because I really didn't know what I was asking, but I was asking, and I will see that. I thank you very much. I will try that, return to the spirit of it, and see if anything changed. Thank you very much, Amy. Hoshi.
You know, it's kind of like I'm watching Tomas sewing his rakusu. The Rakusu, there's like, well, of course, we have this pattern, and you're supposed to do it this way, and blind stitches, and this kind of fabric, and all this stuff. And Joe is making his kesa, it's the same thing. But ultimately, it's like with the precepts. So it's the spirit of it is what's important, and the experience of doing it. The doing it is what's important. And you're supposed to, is every stitch, you know, being one with the Buddha, being one with the Dharma, being one with the Sangha, you're supposed to do that while you're sewing. I don't know how many people actually do it all the time, but that's the spirit of it. And whether the pieces are exactly straight, or there's some stitches visible, or you know, you have this kind of fabric and somebody else has more refined fabric, or it's this length or that length. Really, that's, if we focus on only that, we miss the spirit of it. And if that's what we're focusing on, well then just buy a rakusu from an expert who knows how to make them really well, you know, and you'll have a perfect rakusu. But you will have missed giving entry to God through your rakusu. And that's what matters. Tomas, yes?
Just commenting to Lisa and to Freddie, come a little bit closer. That a huge energy of intention in our rakusus, and we all felt it, is the fact that we were, the three of us, doing together as Sangha and as Buddha Dharma Sangha. And listening to you, I was just realizing that because I forgot, or because I wasn't aware, or I didn't see, I didn't say a single time being one with the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha whilst teaching, which actually I'm going to do now in this last little bit. So it's still timely. This said, I feel the connection with that energy of saying that, and I want to do it because I feel it. And I was just commenting to them that in spite of perhaps we having not done that, there was a collective energy of intention of doing it that...
We were doing it for the Sangha.
And we were doing it for the Sangha.
Also, and
all the story that led to us, the three of us, after so many years deciding to do it together. And now it is connected, as you know, with a meeting that we all had with Joa, when you told us that Joa is also receiving his transmission. So, yeah, there's a lot of... meaning, energy, and love in every little mistake, and there are many, at least in mine, right? Thank you.
In all of ours.
True wildflowers, I tell you. I'm very happy. Yeah, great, wonderful. Debbie?
I just wanted to say how fantastic it's been during this talk, having them working, having the little busy bee mosaic. It's great. We should do this all the time.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I hope you will join in at 4 for the ceremony. Initially, we didn't program it during the official time because it was supposed to be in my garden and just a very small group, Joa and me and these three, and then Delphine, and then a couple of other people. It's still going to be a very small group. And then eventually, Lisa suggested opening it up so that everyone could join if they want to by Zoom. So. And I hope that there's another person on this screen who is working on her rakusu and may have finished it, Seu. It's too bad she couldn't be here with us, but we will do her ceremony when we can. She knows that. Is it finished?
Nope.
Your episode? No. No, it's not finished yet. Okay.
It's almost finished. Finished. Almost. The second part, I need to have a focus to make that.
Good. Okay, we are about out of time. Thank you. Anyone want to say one last thing before we?
I only want to ask you all if you know that a wildflower, Nuno Peixinho, our wildflower member, it's today, his name, it's a name from one asteroid in the universe. Peixinho, it's from the scientific astrophysic community. Is the name gift to one asteroid because of the work for Nuno Peixinho. You know that?
No.
Yeah, it's very, I think it's very interesting. When we can, Nuno, we imagine Nuno is there in the universe, his name is there, and Peixinho, it's little fish.
Oh.
Little fish, it's the name.
Uh-huh.
Later I give you an image from him, many articles in the press come, and it's a one beautiful image. Later I send you. Okay.
Well, thank you. Interesting. Well, and his Dharma name is Hazy Moon.
Yes.
It's also interesting. Yeah. Thank you. And I think Miguel.
The other day, he told me he's going to ask for another Dharma name now.
And Miguel, you wanted to say something?
Yes, thank you. Good morning. It's just to share something I read yesterday. I was listening to you when you were talking about love and the stream and the life of P. And so I suddenly remembered this and just wanted to share with you. It's from a saint from the desert, Saint Macario. I don't know how to translate it. And it says, those, of course, this is a Christian language, but it's very beautiful. Those who are judged worthy of becoming the sons of God and to born in the high from the Holy Spirit, happens to them cry and be afflicted for all humankind, begging to God for all descendants, for all Adam's descendants. If they suffer and cry, it's because they are inflamed by spiritual love for all humankind. After that, again, the spirit brings about in them a total joy and such an impulse of charity that they would want, if it's possible, to close in their hearts all men and women and not distinguish the good from the bad. And this.
Thank you. It sounds to me like, you know, Avalokiteshvara or Kuan Yin or Tianan. Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. I see that Anna has sent the message asking if it's the same link to join for the Jukai. Is it, Lisa, or is it something else?
It's the same. It's the same.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. See you later. Bon appétit.